Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama is asking Congress to approve his plan expanding the wilderness areas of the Alaska Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by an additional 12 million acres. A wilderness designation would block all future development of the land, including oil and gas drilling. Alaska's two senators have already voiced their opposition. That includes Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. Earlier today, I spoke with Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell. Secretary Jewell, we've heard Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and others denounce the president's proposal. Tell us what it entails briefly and why he's doing it now.
The president announced the comprehensive plan by which we will manage the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, an area set aside originally in 1960 and then further defined as wilderness areas in 1980. What this does is direct the Fish and Wildlife Service to manage the area as wilderness. Only Congress can actually designate it as wilderness, but that is the president's recommendation to Congress, and we're delighted that he has stepped up to do it at this time, because there has been ongoing efforts by members of Congress to open the area of the coastal plain up for oil and gas exploration. This was intended to be set aside as a whole ecosystem, and we want to make sure that the president is on record as the administration's position that it is inappropriate to drill there. It's just too special of a place.
So what you're saying is that even though the president has proposed this, it does need congressional approval.
That's correct, Diane. Only Congress can set aside wilderness and wild and scenic river designations, but that is the president's recommendation. But what the plan does is it directs us through the Fish and Wildlife Service to manage it as though it is wilderness. So until the plan is revised or Congress passes a law to tell us to act differently, we will manage it as though it is wilderness.
Tell me why this area should be foreclosed as an option in oil and gas drilling.
Well, Diane, I have been to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and I've also spent quite a bit of time over the course of my career at Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. While oil and gas development can be done safely and responsibly, it does have a significant impact on the environment and ecosystems. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is an incredible place. It is the most special and intact ecosystem in the United States of America, and perhaps even the world. There are places that are just too special to develop, and we believe that this is one of those places. There are places that are set aside for development, like the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. And we sympathize with the state of Alaska and the need for ongoing oil to flow in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. That's the area we believe is the right area to focus, and not the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which we believe should stay unimpaired for future generations as a whole intact ecosystem.
I'm sure you saw the Wall Street Journal's op-ed this morning on this issue, suggesting that the real intention of the president's action is to try to cripple the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Diane, that is nonsense. The administration has been on record. We have been aggressive in supporting lease sales in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. The first segment of that development is under review right now. We're working very closely with industry to support their efforts to put production in that area, and that is already very close to the existing infrastructure and can be done in the near future. So that is an incorrect statement to suggest that we want to do anything other than to continue to have this vital resource flowing that helps reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And we certainly are on record supporting that, and our actions will bear that out. That said, we aren't controlling oil prices, and the speed of the development in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska is certainly going to be impacted by that, and that's an area over which we have no control.
Now, help me to understand, if the president vetoes, if the Congress approves, the president vetoes the Alaska pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline, will the existing pipeline be removed?
The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is not on the table right now in terms of any actions. It is a very, very important tool for moving oil from the North Slope of Alaska to markets in the United States. So there's nothing on the table to remove that pipeline. In fact, it is very important that it keep oil flowing in order to maintain its relevance. If oil does not keep flowing, then the Trans-Alaska Pipeline cannot continue to operate because it needs to be, you know, at a certain level of fullness in order to flow, just because of the temperatures up there. It's completely separate from the Keystone Pipeline. That is a completely separate area and a completely separate topic.
So if there's not enough oil flowing, you're saying that by law that pipeline has to be dismantled?
I'm not aware of any discussions along those lines. It is been our actions as well as our intent to support an ongoing flow of oil from the North Slope of Alaska through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The first area to develop, or the next area to develop, being the National Petroleum Reserve, which does have proven oil and gas reserves and will be a mechanism to keep that oil flowing into the pipeline. As you know, even though it's had some missteps, we have also supported drilling in the Arctic, specifically in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. Those are additional areas where there has been ongoing development. That would also be another source of potential future oil to flow through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So there's nothing in our actions that would suggest anything other than support for continuing that pipeline for the foreseeable future.
I want to also ask you, I gather the Department of Interior is going to release a five-year offshore drilling plan that puts the area north of the pipeline out of bounds.
Well, we will be announcing later on this afternoon a draft proposed plan for our five-year leasing program in the Outer Continental Shelf all around the United States. And that has been based on substantial public comment that we've taken up to this point. While I don't want to get ahead of the announcement that we'll have this afternoon, I will say that there is ongoing support in our draft proposed plan for exploration in both the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. I will also say that there are areas up there and elsewhere in the country that we believe are too special to develop. And so the plan takes into account the areas that we believe are appropriate for development and the areas that we believe are inappropriate for development. And we will be providing detail on that later on today.
Of course, because of the price of oil going down, Alaskans are perhaps already suffering.
I think there's no question that the dependence of the state of Alaska on oil revenues for its budget means that with this 50% drop that they are suffering, they're definitely going to feel the impacts. And the governor and I have talked a number of times about that.
Can you give me a sense of the governor's reaction to all this?
Well, the governor and I had a very thoughtful conversation, and he expressed to me the situation that his state is facing with regard to oil revenues. I talked to him about our understanding of that and our support for moving forward in the National Petroleum Reserve. I think he appreciated that. I think he disagrees with us on the position that the president has taken and we have recommended on management of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But I think he is genuinely in support of working with us on supporting the resources in the areas where it is already developed. That would include, for example, natural gas, which is being reinjected in the North Slope of Alaska, but could open up additional sources of revenue for the state and additional sources of energy for the country. So we've had broad-ranging conversations.
Good.
We may not agree on this issue, but I think there is a lot that we can agree on and work together on with the state of Alaska.
Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Diane.
They say Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
And welcome back. We are now going to talk with our other guests here in the studio. We have Juliet Eilprin of The Washington Post, Myron Ebel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Jamie Williams of the Wilderness Society, and joining us from a CBC studio on Edmonton, Canada, Edward Struzik of Queen's University in Kingston. He's author of Future Arctic. Welcome to you all.
Hello, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you. Juliet, I'll start with you. You've heard from the Secretary exactly what the administration is proposing. How many acres are already designated as wilderness?
I don't know that number off the top of my head, but I do know that if you included this new area, which is 12.8 million acres, 98% of the refuge would be designated as wilderness should this actually become permanent. So, you know, or 97. My understanding from the Interior Department was 98. That's what they told me.
7 million. It's already wilderness.
So 7 million is already wilderness. And so anyway, so it's certainly a huge increase in the percentage.
Okay. And Jamie, for me and for all of our listeners, help me understand what this designation actually means legally.
Well, what it means is that almost the entire Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will be protected in its wild state that it's in now. It'll be free of roads and development and commercial use, but open for recreation and subsistence use by Alaska Natives. It's the strongest protection you can give to land, and this is a place so deserving of it.
And I was about to ask, to what extent do you really think that this designation is necessary?
Well, it's no accident that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge hosts the longest mammal migration on Earth, the porcupine caribou herd that migrates 1,500 miles every year to rear their calves on the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. It's no accident that it's the most important coastal denning area in the Arctic for polar bears, or that millions of birds that nest here migrate to every state in the United States and all continents. This is one of the wildest places in all of North America, if not the globe, because it's so intact. It is beloved by Americans as beloved as Yosemite and the Grand Canyon, and we believe it's really deserving of this protection to protect the wildlife that is there.
And Ed Struzik, I'm sure Canadians love it equally, And you must have seen it firsthand. Describe it for us. Can Ed not hear me? Ed Struzik, I'm afraid he cannot hear me.
I think the follow-up on Jamie said is off.
I'm afraid we've got a bad connection. We'll try that again. Myron Ebel, you say the administration's action is going to stir up a lot of controversy.
Well, I'm sure it does, because if you look at the reaction not only of the Alaska congressional delegation, the two senators, Murkowski and the new senator, Dan Sullivan, also Congressman Don Young, but the reaction of the governor, who is not a Republican, newly elected, they actually live up there, and they are representing the interests of the people of Alaska, including the Native Americans, the Eskimos, who live on the coastal plain and live on the North Slope. And if you look at the immediate reactions of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, which is the big Eskimo corporation, and the Kaktovik Corporation, which is the Eskimos who actually live inside the coastal plain of the Arctic National Refuge, which is a small village in the coastal plain. They are strongly in favor of it, and they believe that the environmental protections and the kind of balance between oil production and environmental protection is quite possible. It's, I think, been proved in Prudhoe Bay over the last 40 years. And so they are quite angry, and I think that will have very definite political repercussions.
What kinds of political repercussions do you see, Jamie?
Well, ultimately, this doesn't change anything on the ground right now. There's no drilling in the Arctic Refuge today, and that can occur without an act of Congress. The president is making a recommendation
right.
that this is deserving, but it's up to Congress and the American people to make this decision.
But you heard Secretary Jewell say that until and unless Congress takes action, the Department of Interior will follow the president's recommendation to treat it as a wildlife refuge.
That is true, and yet at the same time, it's also true that in the Alaska Lands Act of 1980, it said that drilling could not occur in the Arctic Refuge without an act of Congress. So really what this does is it sets forth a presidential, it's the first time a president has stepped forward and says the entire refuge ought to be protected, but it's up to Congress to make the final decision.
Juliet.
I think one of the most interesting things is, in an odd way, while again, yes, we've heard a lot from Alaska, in some ways the real repercussions are here in Washington. And the key to that is Lisa Murkowski, the Alaskan Republican, who first, you know, was as vocal as she was in decrying this. It's incredibly important because she not only is now the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which of course is an important position, but she is also the chair of the subcommittee on appropriations that controls the Interior Department's budget. And in addition to all that, she actually is one of the few moderates, in a sense, who has shown a willingness to work with the administration on certain issues. And so she is an important strategic player for the administration. She had concerns about Secretary Jewell's nomination. She put a hold on her nomination, but ultimately let that go through and has been, again, one of the few Republicans who said that the president has the right to install his own nominees within his administration. And so I think that's going to be a fascinating thing to watch, both in terms of the department itself, but a whole host of issues that could be have ripple effects.
So considering all of that, Juliet, why do you think the president did this now?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One is certainly conservation has become a much higher priority for the president in this second term, and it coincides with the fact that John Podesta, his senior counselor, joined a year ago and is about to leave in just a couple of weeks. And so, first of all, John Podesta has an agenda of what he wants to accomplish before leaving the White House staff. And also the president feels that this is one of the ways that he's going to make his mark. There are very limited options of what he can do with Congress, with a Republican majority in both chambers. And also, you know, I think you also have to keep in mind two other factors. One, the fact that oil prices are so low right now means there's much less anxiety about the need to drill in Alaska, particularly given booming production in the Great Plains. And on top of that, frankly, what's interesting is Mark Begich, when he was running for re-election, the former senator from Alaska, who's a Democrat, argued he held some sway in the White House. The Alaska voters rejected that and obviously elected Dan Sullivan. But I think the administration might have been more hesitant to do this if there had been a Democrat remaining in the Senate from Alaska. And there's not that anymore. And so they don't have that consideration.
Do you agree with that, Myron?
Yes. And I think it will be interesting to see what Senator Murkowski does with Department of Interior appropriations, all the federal land budgets. It seems to me that Secretary Jewell is a great outdoorsman, and perhaps she doesn't need fossil fuels to fly around to all the national parks and up to Alaska. Maybe she can get on her bike, and maybe that would be a good appropriations rider to put in to the interior bill, and all the interior people can get on their bikes instead of the big pickup trucks that they drive around in the BLM and the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service.
Jamie, why do you think the president did this now?
Well, one thing I think we should remember is that every wildlife refuge is required every 15 years to come up with a plan about how to manage the refuge. And so this was that time. There was a lot of public input. There was more than many public meetings, more than a million comments that came in, most in support of protecting the refuge as wilderness. And so I think he did it because it was to follow through on the management plan that's there, but also to put Congress on notice that he's not going to be up for drilling in the Arctic refuge, knowing that those attacks were going to be coming.
What about climate change? Do you think that's also a factor here, Myron?
I don't think it really is, but it may be put forward as one. I mean, the president has taken great credit for the boom in oil and gas production in this country. And he said that when he went to Brazil, he was looking forward to getting imports of Brazilian oil into the United States. He's in Saudi Arabia today to pay his respects to the late king of Saudi Arabia, who Saudi Arabia is the world's first or second oil producer. I think now we're probably first. And so, he's quite happy to import oil from Brazil, but not from Alaska. So it's a strange. So apparently, the environment can be protected offshore in Brazil in very deep water, thousands and thousands of feet of sea, but it can't be protected on the coastal plain of Alaska.
Juliet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this is also a moment we're saying where the president is focused on the Arctic more broadly. In fact, the United States is going to take the chair of something called the Arctic Council in June, and I think you're going to see Secretary Kerry from State is going to be making that a big focus. So this is also a moment. You alluded to the 5-year offshore leasing plan that's coming out today. It is also a moment when, in the face of climate change, the administration is looking at this region and saying, what are we going to do in the long term?
So what difference will this designation really make, Juliet?
Well, in the short term, it means that it will be managed as wilderness, which, again, it had been in the past, but it makes it clearer because the Fish and Wildlife Service hadn't been on record with that. But really, it's just going to depend on, frankly, who the next administration is. Essentially, it does kind of, in some ways, raise the bar higher for drilling there. But you could have, for example, a Republican administration come in and issue a new plan now. As Jamie alluded to, there's a process you'd have to go through in order to do that. But this could be reversed, but it certainly makes the de facto status here much stronger in favor of keeping it wild.
And I gather, Jamie, that there are even other prohibitions expected from the administration in terms of drilling in the Arctic Ocean?
Well, I think the administration's approach to energy development is really one of balance, that we can get the energy we need and protect the places that America loves. And I think that that's what you're seeing here in the Arctic as well. They're moving forward, and as Secretary Jewell said, with energy development in the National Petroleum Reserve, I understand, and they've certainly been trying to move forward with drilling in the Arctic Ocean, which we think presents enormous risks. And we'll see more of an announcement on that today. But I think what you're going to see is a balanced approach where they want to protect sensitive areas and areas that are important for subsistence for Alaska Natives, and at the same time, they're going to continue to advance drilling in other places and what they believe are the most compatible places.
What about fishing rights? Is that coming into this at all, Myron?
Well, the people who live up there very strongly support oil and gas development in the coastal plain. And they are the indigenous people, the Eskimos, who have fishing rights and who hunt fish and whales and seals. So and caribou. And, you know, the idea that we can drill off the shore in the Arctic Ocean with more environmental protection than on the coastal plain seems ridiculous to me. I think both places can be developed with environmental protection can be balanced against oil production, but clearly it's safer to do it onshore than it is offshore. And yet we're having lots of leasing, not much drilling yet, but we have had quite a bit of leasing in the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, and the Beaufort Sea is where the coastal plain of Anwar is. So it seems to me if we want to have both environmental protection and oil production, we ought to be looking at the coastal plain.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But as I understand it, there could be a proposal to stop drilling in the Arctic Ocean as well.
What my sources have told me, but we have to wait and see what happens, is that the administration in this draft five-year plan will withdraw some areas that previously had been available for leasing from development on the grounds that they are too sensitive. That would be, again, from what I understand from former interior officials, unprecedented, and certainly kind of shows that I know Myron's making a distinction between offshore and onshore, but I think in the administration's perspective, they actually aren't necessarily making that distinction. They are trying to put a stake in the ground. These are areas we think are inappropriate to explore both offshore and onshore. We actually recently saw the president declare part of Bristol Bay would be unacceptable to do oil and gas development offshore. And so I think that they talk about looking on a landscape level and putting certain places off limits, absolutely, whether they're in the sea or whether they're on land.
Should there be that distinction, Jamie?
I think there should. I mean, most of the North Slope is open for business right now. You know, the protected wilderness inside the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge right now only constitutes 5% of the North Slope. So we believe that there are areas that you can develop. There's a lot of development going on in northern Alaska, and there's areas that are so biologically sensitive and also important as a subsistence resource locally that they should be avoided.
You know, a few years back, Myron, we were reading about an Arctic land grab, different nations seeking to control different parts of the Arctic Ocean. What's the status there now?
That's a very interesting question. If global warming theory is correct, the Arctic will open up in the summers and the ice pack will melt to a smaller and smaller size. And so various countries want to claim a chunk of the Arctic in order to get the rights to drill closer to the North Pole. And Russia has the biggest coastline. Canada has the second largest. Norway and Denmark have significant coastlines. So Denmark owns Greenland. And the United States has it's in the same range as Denmark and Norway. So everybody is going to try to get a chunk, a pie slice of that. The biggest pie slice will be Russia's.
Myron Ebel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Short break here. When we come back, we will be joined by Edward Struzik of Kingston, Canada. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from the investment firm of Raymond James, Wealth Management, Banking, and Capital Markets. Learn more at lifewellplanned.com. From PBS with Edison from American Experience, the story of the genius behind recorded sound, motion pictures, and electric light, hallmarks of the modern age. Edison, tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, living in Afghanistan, one former journalist saw how pervasive political corruption can lead to violent extremism. She calls for urgent action by the U.S. and a new approach to foreign policy, how corruption threatens global security. The Ian Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. As we talk about the president's statement that he, and directive actually, that he wants to expand the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and prohibit any further drilling for oil in the area. Joining us now is Edward Struzik. He's at the Queen's Institute for Energy and Conservation and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. He's the author of a new book titled Future Arctic. Edward Struzik, what do you make of this controversy, the president's statement, Lisa Murkowski's anger over it all? How do you see it?
Well, it's the same old story. I mean, it goes right back to the 1970s and the 1980s and 1990s. We've seen this played out so many times. I covered the Anwar controversy back in the 1980s, and the language is almost exactly the same. I think the difference now is we may be coming to the end or the beginning of the end of frontier oil and gas development if we don't see oil and gas prices rise dramatically. And the reason why is that the cost of drilling in these remote areas has risen dramatically, and the reserves just are not big enough, unless something really, they pull the rabbit out of the hat, we're not going to see another Prudhoe Bay. And so historically, what we've seen, it's waxing and waning. And I think in this case, you know, with oil prices down, Obama has done what Juliet has mentioned, taken out an insurance policy for the future and said, okay, we are not going to make a lot of money out of this. Let's protect caribou, which are incredibly important as a subsistence economy to the native people who live up there. And I think this is part of a larger plan by the Obama administration, because I was just in China with your oceans ambassador, David Bolton, who's trying to engage the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans and a lot of non-Arctic states to consider not fishing in the central Arctic Ocean. So there's something else at play here. I think it's a bigger vision, part of a bigger vision, and we're going to hear more about it this afternoon.
You know, it's interesting. The Wall Street Journal is saying this morning that the Arctic outer continental shelf is estimated to hold at least 27 billion barrels of oil, while Anwar is thought to have at least 10 billion. And the NPRA is equally rich, but you're saying there's not all that much oil there.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of oil, but it's accessible oil, and it's the cost of getting that oil out. And it's also the risks associated of getting that oil out. And that is why we've seen, you know, Mackenzie Valley oil and gas, you know, there's been an attempt to get that to move south, and it's failed twice. And why has it failed? Because it's just too costly to get it out of there.
What do you think, Myron?
Well, I agree. It's always a matter of how much it costs to produce versus
sure.
the price you're getting.
Yeah.
The point is that the coastal plain is very close to Prudhoe Bay, where the pipeline starts, and it's thought that the oil is quite accessible and quite inexpensive to get out. The pipeline has already been built. It's one of the great engineering marvels of the modern world. And so when they say at least 10 billion barrels, we don't know because there hasn't been exploratory drilling. There could be a lot more, could be less. It seems to me we ought to find out before we lock up this resource. If there's very little oil there and it's expensive to get out, then let's go ahead and lock it up. If there's a huge amount of oil and it's rather inexpensive to get out, I think the American people would side with let's drill it.
Ed, how do you respond?
I take the opposite point of view. I think that we should take the precautionary approach, protect caribou, which are more important to the people who live in that area in the long term. And I think that we should also accept the fact that the Arctic is changing, and it's changing very, very fast, and we should start planning for the future. And I think that this decision by the president is a prudent one. It is an insurance policy for the future. And with further announcements, I think it's a visionary thing. It's interesting to see that I think he's probably the first Western leader who is really trying to grasp, you know, how is the world going to change in the Arctic, and what can we do about it? And I think, you know, part of it is not to eliminate oil and gas development, not to eliminate mining, but to protect those biological hotspots.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's always really interesting with this is the tensions in these policy decisions. And again, the different people who are invested in it, they're the people who live there. There's also the idea with wilderness as defined, you know, by our laws, that that's land that belongs to every American. So you're navigating this. And again, you're doing this at a time when the administration is taking a much longer term vision of what the impact of its policies are going to be.
Juliet, during the break, you and Myron were speculating as to how Senator Lisa Murkowski might respond to all this. What is your guesstimate?
I think she's going to go after various interior appropriations that she disagrees with, and I think she will probably do some personal targeting here. I think this is now a personal issue for her. I think she feels that she has been treated, and the state of Alaska has been treated extremely unfairly. And, you know, Senator Murkowski cares a great deal for the environment. Ed Struzik said, we've got to worry about the caribou herd. Well, the same claims were made at Prudhoe Bay back in the 70s when there were 6,000 caribou in that herd. Today, there are 60,000 caribou in the Prudhoe Bay area herd. So clearly, oil and gas development and production can go along with environmental protection. And that's why the natives who actually live on the north slope of Alaska support it. It's some Indian tribes that live several hundred miles away who tried to, put out their own land for oil and gas development, but they didn't find any there. So I think, you know, when we talk about the rights and interests of the people who live there, we ought to actually listen to the people who live there, and that's the Eskimos.
Ed?
Well, I mean, I think you can make the argument that caribou and oil and gas pipelines can cohabitate, but I think the important fact here is the coastal plain is an important calving ground. And the porcupine caribou has been on decline for 30 years, and we got good news recently that it's rebounded, and it rebounded for two reasons. One is that there was serious restrictions put on native hunters and non-native hunters, and also that there was just no development whatsoever on the coastal plain so that those animals could reproduce. And I think we're bearing the fruits of that policy now.
All right, let's open the phones. We'll go first to George in Houston, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me. I wanted to ask a more general question. It seems to me that we've kind of scrutinized all the environmental issues and the concerns behind the president's order, but if you look at the price of oil and the fact that it's actually gone through the floor over the past year, roughly a third of what it was before, and the reserves the U.S. has now are the highest on record, there must be some special interest driving this opposition to Anwar, because if you look at the national interest, it shouldn't be a priority. And so I wonder, and especially when I hear one of your guests question why Barack Obama is concerned about offshore drilling from Brazil, when in fact he's the president of the United States, and that's why he's concerned about the environment in Alaska. So comments like that really shouldn't go unchallenged. But who are the special interests driving this is really what my question is, because if you look at the big picture, this is a no-brainer. We don't need to talk about caribou. We need to be talking about things other than these scrutinized environmental interests. The environmental issue here is overwhelmingly more powerful and has a stronger interest than some special interests driving the need to drill in the future.
All right. Thanks for your call, Myron.
Well, I disagree. I think there's some confusion in your caller. You know, the price of oil goes up and down. In 1995, President Clinton vetoed the Anwar bill that Congress presented him with that would have opened up the coastal plain. And some of the environmental groups said, and it may have been the Wilderness Society, I forget, said, well, this won't help the current high price of gasoline because it will take 10 years to start producing in Anwar. Well, it's now along, it's 1995, it's 20 years. We could have had oil flowing from Anwar that would be benefiting the American economy, American consumers. And it seems to me we ought to elect leaders and we ought to expect more of our leaders than thinking 2 or 3 months ahead. They ought to be thinking 10, 20, 30 years ahead.
Juliet.
Well, you know, obviously oil's a global market. As Myron pointed out earlier, we are in fact benefiting as much from Saudi Arabia flooding the market as we would be for this oil coming from Alaska. I do think that one real issue, and again, this does challenge some of what your caller is saying, is that, of course, the oil industry is in favor of this, but Alaska really needs this oil because they have been outpaced by North Dakota. They need oil in that pipeline. So there actually is absolutely a state interest to some extent in developing this resource, but that doesn't necessarily translate into the national interest. That's part of the tension we're talking about here.
Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think, Juliet's right. There's a great state interest here, and it's, if we could learn lessons from the past, then the state might have done what Norway did, is put some of those assets in the bank so that they could get through this period of low oil prices. And we've seen, many oil-dependent economies collapse because they just depend, there's just too much dependence on this one product. And we've seen the cycle go up and down so many times, and nobody seems to learn the lesson that you've got to take insurance policy.
Okay, let's go to Laz, who's in Miami, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I know I probably live the furthest from Alaska, and I'm enjoying some pretty nice weather, but I'm responding to the comment actually that was just made about Alaska really needs this oil. But that's been the situation, historically. What have the representatives of the people of Alaska, what's been done to diversify themselves from this dependence on oil?
Good question, Ed.
You asked the proper question. Is that Alaska has motored on as if oil was always going to sustain their economy, and it won't. Prudhoe Bay is drying up. They need to find other sources of oil. That oil is becoming extremely expensive to extract. They didn't put money in the bank as perhaps they should have. We see the same thing here in Canada with the Alberta government is now, in serious peril because they devoted so much effort on developing the tar sands. And now they're cutting back, thinking about cutting back on education, cutting back on health care, and also introducing, God forbid, a sales tax, which could actually defeat a government here.
well, you know, Alaska has tried to diversify, but they have some problems. And largely the problems are the federal government and the federal land agencies. Virtually all of Alaska is government owned. A lot of federal land, a lot of native corporation land, which is private but cannot be sold or broken up, and then state land. So, for example, the proposed Pebble Mine is on state land that was reserved for mining. And the Department of the Interior and President Obama's administration are trying to block that very huge mine, which would provide a huge economic boost to the southwest Alaska, the opposite end of the state from Anwar. So, you know, they're trying, but they've got the federal government in the way.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Juliet, tell me what the process is now. Congress is certainly unlikely to approve the president's plan. So what happens?
Well, first of all, there's a 30-day comment period on this comprehensive conservation plan. So it would be published in the Federal Record. People could comment on it before it's formally adopted, and there's no question in anyone's mind that it will be adopted. Then, right, Congress could choose to, and you very well could see a vote and an attempt to overrule this wilderness protection and try to, you know, allow for drilling. But it seems pretty clear that Democrats still have enough votes in the Senate to block it. And again, even if a bill like that would get to the president's desk, he would be sure to veto it. He's shown quite a willingness to veto bills this in these last 2 years. So I think at this point, it's really a question of it seems hard to see that it would change for the next 2 years, and then we just have to see what happens in 2017.
So without congressional approval and designation, as the president has asked, are any development projects likely to move forward?
No. In this area, no. There's the NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, where half of it has been set aside for conservation and half of it is open to development. And so that's where you'd see things moving forward. And we might see some news out of Chevron and the Interior Department fairly soon on that front.
What do you think, Myron?
Well, the problem with the National Petroleum Reserve is, as Juliet said, half of it has already been put off limits. But the second problem is nobody thinks it has very much oil compared to the coastal plain of Anwar. And so in 1980, when Congress enlarged Anwar, which included the coastal plain, you have to remember this is a huge area. It's as big as the state of South Carolina or the state of Maine. The coastal plain is less than 10% of it. They said we have to decide whether the coastal plain can allow oil development and not ruin the refuge. It has to be in harmony with the purposes of the wildlife refuge. In 86, that study came out, and it was found, yes, oil production can go ahead, and it would be in harmony. It would not violate the purposes of the refuge or harm the environment of the refuge. So we've been, as Ed and I think several of us have said, we've been going around and around on this since the late 80s.
Ed, I'm going to give you the last brief word. What difference do you believe an expanded wilderness designation could make?
I think it could, you know, secure the future fate of those wildlife populations, the polar bears that den there, the caribou, and also the food supply, the food security of those people who live on the north slope of Alaska.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.